Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. WikiLeaks was forced to switch to a Swiss domain name after a hacker attack prompted its American provider to withdraw service. WikiLeaks has released nearly 700 of the 250,000 classified U.S. documents it says it has on file. The U.S. told the U.N. nuclear watchdog North Korea may have built more than one uranium enrichment facility, and momentum appears to be growing for ratification of the new START treaty. One additional item, we've just learned from the Associated Press that President Obama has slipped unannounced into Afghanistan this morning, 1 year after widening an ever deadlier war, and just days before a pivotal review about the 9-year-plus conflict. Joining us in the studio for the International Hour of the News Roundup, David Loyne of the BBC, Nadia Bilbasi of the Middle East Broadcast Center, and James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine. Your comments are always welcome. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you. Happy Friday.
Good morning, Dan.
James Kitfield is surprised that President Obama would show up in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I am surprised at that. I would have probably expected to see General Petraeus come here, but there is this big review that's when he announced his Afghan surge last December, said there would be a review at the year mark, so we're at the year mark of the surge. Everyone's looking to see what General Petraeus is going to say. I think we pretty much it's all been telegraphed at this point. He's going to claim they've shifted the momentum. Momentum, he's going to say, is now with U.S. forces. They have continued this sort of slow motion offensive in Kandahar, trying to kick the Taliban basically out of their stronghold. But obviously, Obama wanted to get a little ground truth himself. He's going to meet with Karzai. As we've learned from these WikiLeaks cables, that relationship remains extremely tenuous. Those leaks were told us what we already knew, but there's just an unremitting negative view of Karzai and the Afghan government being awash in corruption and graft, and that could be a fatal flaw, as Ambassador Eikenberry says in our counterinsurgency strategy there, because without a government to fill that vacuum, you never get beyond clearing a place.
Nadia.
I'm actually not surprised. I think at this time of the year, the commander-in-chief normally goes to where the troops are in the battlefield and shows its support. We've seen that with President Bush. We've seen it with President Obama before. I think the security issue is he wanted to have a cover before we come closer to Christmas time, and then he's busy in Washington. So the timing, I don't think, is surprising. At the same time, I think it's very important for him to go and to see what's happening on the ground.
For himself.
And this is a president, by the way, who's been criticized very often that he hasn't been to Afghanistan as many times as he should have been. So this is his second visit, I think, after being a president, and it's important for him to be there on the ground to see the generals, especially as James just said, after the WikiLeaks and all the information that came, and to assure the American public of his stand.
David Lloyd.
Yeah, it's been the toughest year for U.S. troops. A third of U.S. casualties in 2010, and I mean, I agree with James absolutely that General Petraeus's review will be upbeat. You know, there's been more violence because the momentum of the war is far tougher. But I think, you know, the WikiLeaks stuff shows really a problem with U.S. policy right at the heart of it. The stuff in today's leaks, and the fascinating thing about these WikiLeaks is that they've been, you know, issued day by day by day. So you get a whole story every day. And today's story is an Afghan story from WikiLeaks. And it shows that American officials are willing to work alongside the most corrupt Afghans, effectively putting warlords in place. If those guys turn out to be the people who can have some kind of stability against the Taliban insurgency. I mean, there's one, just to quote from one of the leaks, Western officials now walk a thin tightrope when walking with this allegedly corrupt official, one who's named, who's also a security stabilization force. So the dilemma is, how do you stabilize? How do they ultimately begin to get out? You know, there is a political imperative now to begin the surge reverse by 2011, which is, of course, you know, coming up very soon, and to stop all combat operations by 2015. Now, if they're going to do that, then they need credible Afghans in place. But the WikiLeaks revelations reveal that the people they're putting in place are some pretty unspeakable characters.
It's not really news, but to see it in this sort of unfiltered, unvarnished way can't help but give you pause that, this is going to, if there is a fatal flaw in this, as I said, in this strategy, I think it's been identified as the Karzai government and the level of corruption that is just endemic there. And, because coin strategy is pretty, excuse me for using that acronym, hanging on the military too long, but counterinsurgency strategy is very holistic and requires that to win the population to the government. And that, if the government's this corrupt and is viewed by even the top American officials that way, and that's come out, it makes it difficult.
All right. How does this change the American public's view of what's happening in Afghanistan? On the one hand, you may have General Petraeus saying things are going fine, we're making progress. On the other hand, you have reports of this kind of corruption direct firsthand from WikiLeaks. How does that change the picture? It sure does in my mind.
Well, the American public's gone south on this war already.
A long time ago.
Majority just don't support it anymore. But no president wants a sort of Saigon rooftop sort of image on his watch, i.e. pulling out of there and letting the thing fall apart. But there's a level
of engagement and interest and understanding of Afghanistan in a way that there wasn't before. I mean, this is already America's longest war. It's the longest invasion of Afghanistan, the longest time foreign troops have been in the country ever. Now, as long as the Russians in their period in the 1980s. And there are increasing signs of the U.S. administration and, of course, the British government have many troops there as well, the second largest number of troops, looking at how the Russians got out in the 1980s and beginning to try and learn the lessons of history.
How did the Russians get out?
Interestingly enough, from about 1985, they did exactly the same thing that Americans were saying, is we'll have one last big push of a lot of troops. And then we'll if we don't win, then we'll leave. And I mean, the Americans are not quite saying the same thing. They're not saying if we don't win, we'll leave. They're hoping to win. I mean, my day job is with the BBC, but I'm actually over in the US in connection with a British drama company who've been put on a series of plays. They're opening in New York this weekend called The Great Game at the Skirball Center in New York. You've already missed them in Washington, Diane, but they're in New York at the moment. And I tell you, there is the people who've come to those plays are interested in the history. People are now beginning to try and understand what's happening in Afghanistan. So there's much more engagement, although, as James says, the opinion polls are moving very fast against any further foreign engagement in the country.
I think one point I'll add here is the problem is not exposing these corruptions. We all know about it, and WikiLeaks only confirmed what everybody knew. The problem is, what's the alternative? What are you going to do? Who is the alternative to Karzai? And that's the dilemma that the Americans have to deal. Yeah. On every level that they have, also they have a bad example. We didn't have the CIA having senior officials being on the payroll of the American government. They're also corrupt.
The tragedy is there are plenty of non-corrupt Afghan officials, and these cables show that they've been dislodged one after another after another. There are plenty of good individuals, and the Karzai and his cronies are beginning to emerge as a sort of a really corrupt and quite cruel elite at the top of Afghanistan. Buttressed by, frankly, U.S. tax dollars, and the unsavory bit is the good Afghans have either been killed or dislodged.
I want to get to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, because British intelligence is said to know where he's hiding. There is the Swedish government saying that he's charged with rape. How much of this do you believe has been made up because all these governments are so angry that he has released this material, James?
It's a very good question in the back of my mind. I mean, the Swedish government's a fairly liberal, progressive government. You wouldn't think there was no evidence that they would have this arrest warrant out for him. However, he says this has all been trumped up by foreign intelligence services. That's absolutely possible. But I would be feeling very uncomfortable if I was this individual at this point. We have the Justice Department who has launched a criminal investigation, whether he can be basically charged for spying under our Espionage Act. You've got this rape charge out there. His own home country says it will arrest him and extradite him on the rape charge if he goes home. You have his sites being attacked by, you know, unknown hackers,
and
but
now
very sophisticated attacks.
He's forced to change the domain.
From Amazon.com, from the American domain. I mean, he is.
And friendship kicked him off.
Well, I mean, he's
well.
Not made any friends, basically. I mean, except for there's a few people who think that, you know, let all the light in, everything should be in the open here, and he's a hero, sort of a media hero. But there are a lot of governments in the world who see what he is doing as very dangerous.
But what has surprised you most about what's been released?
Well, if I had to point to two things, and my major surprise is that I'm not surprised. I mean, almost everything he's done has been reported. We've reported it, and it gives you some confidence that what you get on background and sometimes on the record from people is the unvarnished truth, although filtered a little more diplomatically than in some of these cables, which are very snarky and in some cases kind of amusing. We learned that Sarkozy is arrogant. Oh, you know, big wow. We didn't know that. We learned that Berlusconi is a bit crazy. Well, yeah, we knew that too. We learned that Karzai is corrupt. Yeah, again, all of this has been reported. But two bits of information kind of struck me. China apparently does understand that the reunification of the Korean Peninsula is likely and will not oppose that forever. That's a little bit. I haven't heard that before. I thought they were really against that. And secondly, our concern about Pakistan's nuclear weaponry is much more acute than I thought it was.
James Kitfield of National Journal Magazine. We'll take a short break here. Your calls, your comments in our next segment. Here's a comment from our website about WikiLeaks from Al, who says, I'm a retired Vietnam vet, retired military officer. WikiLeaks is the best thing to happen in a long time. The only damage done is damage to the pride of our diplomats by exposing their lack of competence and the fact that they use the secret label to hide behind that incompetence. Obviously, volumes could and have been written on the subject. It's time to bring all the facts into the open. And David Loy, I gather you have seen Julius Assange recently.
Yeah, he spends a fair amount of time in London. He spends some time in a journalist club, which I happen to be a member of. In fact, we had our annual party last week. We had a charity auction. One of the things we auctioned was dinner with Julian Assange, which went for just £200 you could have had. I don't know whether he'd still be able to deliver on that. That's some $300. And we also auctioned a wig, which he said to have worn because he moves around under various false identities. So Julian Assange's wig actually went for more than dinner with the guy. But but he's there. I mean, look, he's not a journalist. He's a hacker. And what's been really interesting about the material that's come out this time is that it is now being discerned by, you know, some pretty good media organizations around the world, the New York Times, the Guardian, Le Monde, serious journals, which are looking at the material. And the frank and real reaction of the U.S. administration is in Hillary Clinton's comments at her press conference when she said, well, you should see what they say about us. And, you know, when Robert Gates, the defense secretary, says, embarrassing, yes, awkward, yes, consequences for U.S. foreign policy, I think fairly modest. And I think that's the frank truth of
that's
this
the question. Courtney in Dallas says, I'm so conflicted about the WikiLeaks matter. By comparison, I did not think the outing of Valerie Plame was right. It put people's lives at risk. WikiLeaks does the same thing. At the same time, a democratic society demands transparency. Perhaps a distinction between the two leaks can be made on the basis of the intent behind the leak. I don't think anyone would say Valerie Plame's identity was leaked as means of holding the government accountable, James.
I share her sense of confliction, I must admit. You know, as a journalist, you want to shine the light on everything, basically. But I was, in reading through some of these cables, reminded of the Jim Carrey movie Liar Liar, where he is forced in that conceit of that movie to tell the truth all the time. And it becomes dysfunctional and in some cases dangerous because, you know, we have many layers of in our human discourse where we are polite on the surface, say things slightly more frankly in private, and then amongst ourselves are, you know, brutally honest. And that's there for a reason. And if the going in assumption now is that everything people say in private to U.S. diplomats is going to hit the light of day, I think it'll lead to less frankness and actually less openness than you have
now.
Perhaps it'll lead to better security. I mean, much of this stuff, shouldn't have been secret, but the stuff that should have been secret wasn't kept under lock and key. I mean, there was 2 million U.S. citizens had access to this material, and the fact that a guy can put a Lady Gaga CD into his computer and download 250,000 documents.
That's interesting.
I think what's interesting about the WikiLeaks is not just information that we didn't know. We knew the information, but now we have an evidence. There is a time, there is a name, there is a place of where these things have been said. And I think the difference when you have the Gulf States leaders talking about bombing Iran, we have him on the record now as opposed to say we think that they did. Number one. Number two is this information is no longer limited to the foreign policy wonks, to the politicians, to interested journalists like us. It's made available to millions of hundreds of millions of people across the world. I think the two points that I found interesting about it, number one is the U.S. diplomats have been asked to spy on U.N. officials in the United Nations to collect personal information about the DNA data, about the credit cards transactions, about passwords to their emails.
Of course, we don't know asked by whom.
We know because I was at the State Department and I asked this very question, and they said that the intelligence services basically have been telling the diplomats to do it. They're not obliging them. They tell them if they have this information, they can pass it along. And I think this is blurring the line between diplomacy and espionage. And in the process, I think the word security is paramount now after a world of 9/11. We have to look at it differently because everything is viewed from the prism of security. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to collect this information, and I think this is really an important
You mentioned point. The one story which I think made the WikiLeaks stuff, you know, justifiable, which is the fact that Arab countries have been putting such pressure on the U.S. to bomb Iran. Now, if that's happening, if there's a likelihood of a new war in the Middle East, then I think we kind of have a right to know about that stuff. And there must have been a way of divulging that without embarrassing or keeping those sources secret. I mean, that's not like secret talks. That's not like, you know, I mean, things like peace in Northern Ireland was made because over 15 years, British Secret Service had secret channels of communication with the insurgents, with the terrorists.
And
now,
and
if those had been made public, we'd never have made peace in Northern Ireland.
But the
fact that the King of Saudi Arabia wants to bomb Iran is not a secret like that. It's the sort of thing that we actually, as the public, have a right to know, and journalists
absolutely.
Need to report.
And some argue that if we have the same information, if we had WikiLeaks before the invasion of Iraq, we might have not have that war, because people will start questioning actually the evidence against the Iraqis.
Point, and that's James.
Well, I'll be the devil's advocate here. I take all those points, and I agree. I was interesting to see Saudi Arabia, you know, cut the head off the snake and try and encourage us to bomb Iran. However, we knew that the Arab governments were encouraging us, and behind the scenes, I mean, our diplomats have been telling reporters this, that whenever they go over there, their biggest friend is Iran, and it's got everyone scared, and all those countries are supporters privately, but even if we did bomb publicly, they'll come out against it. We knew that. It's a granularity you get when you see their actual comments. It's useful. I'll tell you a place where it's possibly not useful. We also know that Zardari in Pakistan plays a double game, where he gives a wink and a nod to these drone strikes, but domestically, for domestic political purpose, says, you know, we oppose them. Well, he comes out and says that in these leaks, and says that, you know, we'll let them bomb and I'll go up in the National Assembly, protest, and then we'll ignore it. Well, if he gets toppled for some reason, for information that was just his own public sees what a lying person he is, that could be very unhelpful to us.
I want to go back to what you said, James, about China and the coming together of the two Koreas, if indeed that happens. At the same time, you've got South Korea making these noises that if there are more attacks, they're going to be much rougher in their dealings with North Korea.
This situation in the Korean Peninsula is very, very dangerous. The reason is this is not normal behavior for North Korea. Normally, it does a one-off provocation, gets back to, you know, as a way to sort of rattle its cage, and then we sit down and talk with it and get back to talks over at six-party talks. It's had three in this last year. It sunk a South Korean boat, killed 46 sailors. It revealed this new uranium enrichment plant, something we had suspected but didn't know actually existed. And then it lobbed artillery shells into a South Korean island, all at a time when there's a transition going on to this young 27-year-old son of Kim Jong-il, who's now a general. And it makes you wonder whether he's a much more dangerous leader who's coming and showing his oats, or the military doesn't like this transition and is showing its oats. We don't know with North Korea. But we are very worried about this. You know, this is a new kind of volatility that is kind of out of character, even for the craziest regime in the world.
Yeah, no, it is end game for this regime. It's, you know, Kim Jong-il is not well. His son is educated in the West, but nobody really seems to know him. I mean, nobody knows this Kim Jong-un. He's not, you know, somebody who the international community have had any relationships with. And there's an element of North Korea, you know, when they revealed in the way that they did, showing to U.S. officials that they had this uranium enrichment facility, there's an element of the spoiled child. You know, me too. We too want to play, you know, with the international community. And, you know, they want to get back into negotiations. And, of course, in the middle of all this are the poor, suffering Korean people who the World Food Program say nearly half of them reliant on food aid. And there's quite a cynical kind of deal every time, which is denuclearization for aid. So it literally is food for behaving better. And the U.S. is not willing to talk about that at the moment, quite understandably.
But the question becomes, how willing is China to try to rein in North Korea?
I think the secret here is China, as you said, Diane. I think China is the strongest, the only ally for the North Koreans. They provide them 90% of their energy, 40% of their food. And some analysts saying basically that the United States and China should get together to talk about how we can solve the problem, or even they're talking about unification. And if you're going to unify these two Koreas, you have to give China some assurances that you're not going to have a nuclear country on their doorsteps, and you're not going to have U.S. troops.
I think we're seeing a historic shift. I think up until now, China has wanted a buffer, and they've been happy to have North Korea between them and South Korea. And remember, the Korean War is not formally over. The 1953 armistice was a temporary ceasefire. And the prospect of China and U.S. Troops getting involved on the ground again seems extraordinarily unlikely. But it's not completely beyond the realms of possibility with a million-man army facing South Korea across a heavily mined border. I mean, war is possible, but China now appears to be moving towards this sort of far more pragmatic view. And the WikiLeaks, as James says, shows there a new pragmatism, really, and a willingness for the two Koreas to be united.
David Loin, he's foreign correspondent for the BBC, author of In Afghanistan, 200 Years of British Russian and American occupation. Nadia Bill Basie, senior U.S. correspondent for Middle East Broadcast Center, and James Kitfield, senior correspondent for National Journal Magazine. And we will open the phones in just a moment. But Nadia, I want to ask you about Egypt and the pulling out of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood and another opposition group out of parliamentary elections. Why?
Well, number one is we have a parliamentary election that contested over 508 seats in the Egyptian parliament. The ruling National Democratic Party has won a landslide of 97%. All the opposition leaders, including the Muslim Brotherhood, who, by the way, secured 20% of the votes of the last previous election in 2005, boycotted the election. They call it the same for human rights organization and international observers who were not allowed to monitor the election, by the way. They called it a sham. It was marred with irregularities. There were ballots has been stuffed. It was so the media was restricted. Opposition were not given names till the last minute. It shows many interesting factors. Number one is that the regime is really desperate to hold in on power and consolidate its position. And now the opposition has boycotted. The Muslim Brotherhood failed to secure one seat even. It shows that Egypt now become a de facto one-party state, not even a token opposition. And the problem here is we might see a serious obstacles and problems to come in terms of the opposition. What do you do with them? If they are not channeled through a political system and peaceful ways, they're going to resort to other ways, could be violent, to express their grievances and their displeasure with the regime. And the other problem they will have is with the U.S., because the United States is the largest donor to Egypt. $1.3 billion they give to the Egyptian government. They cannot afford just to pay lip service to democracy in the Middle East. They have to rethink their policies.
Nadia Bill Basie of Middle East Broadcasting Center, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. James, the United States called those elections worrying, but who wants the Muslim Brotherhood to be part of that parliament?
Well, we're not on in sync with the agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is an Islamist party, but is trying to work, as my colleague said, through the political system. So you want that. I mean, that is a positive thing. You want these debates to be handled in a political dialogue, not people resort to terrorism and violence. So I think we're disturbed by this. We had hoped, certainly the Bush administration pushed very hard as part of its democracy agenda to put some pressure on Egypt. And they found it wasn't very, Egypt kind of complied. And that's when the Muslim Brotherhood got this 20% of seats in the parliament. And everyone's went, oh, my goodness, what are we going to do now? So I don't think the Obama administration has been pressuring them too hard. But it just goes to show this is not a democratic regime. The succession next year is going to be a handoff from father to son. And anyone who wants to depict Egypt as a functioning democracy hasn't been paying close enough attention.
And yeah. David Lloyd, I want to ask you about the latest on efforts by European officials to deal with their debt crisis.
This is very serious, Diane. I mean, this is Ireland last week suddenly felt like 2008 all over again. I mean, the Financial Times suddenly doubles its circulation. You have a real sense of unease that our near neighbour is suddenly calling in the IMF. The International Monetary Fund called in last weekend in order to literally bail out the country, and they kept them out for as long as they could, but finally the IMF came in and said, no, you've got to take this money. It's like it was like a child not taking its medicine, and they poured down their throats in order, frankly, to save the Irish economy, which has now an 85 billion euro. That's
113 million.
There you are. Thank you very much, James. He's done the math on this. But it is basically it's more than twice the GDP of the country. I mean, the country is effectively bankrupt. They've been trying to hold this off, because they are the sort of the new high tech place in Europe. But this is for the first time the biggest threat to the eurozone and to the euro currency,
but
and all these countries coming together in one currency.
It's
in 1999.
Not just Ireland. Right. It is now Portugal. It is Italy.
It's Portugal, Spain, Greece was bailed out last year. and the unwillingness of the German taxpayer, who basically ultimately picks up the bill, to carry on picking up the bill, is going to be the thing that breaks the euro.
Well, and the question is there a chance that the European Union itself is going to break up, James?
I agree with David. The European Union is not going to break up, but I think the euro. You could conceivably draw the thing a scenario where the euro becomes untenable. I mean, and David puts his finger on it. As soon as the German public says no more, who's going to pick up these bailouts?
I mean, the problem for all these countries is that they can't devalue their way out of the crisis any longer because they're part of the euro. You know, what they used to do would be to devalue their currency and then be able to export again and therefore to grow. But any countries in, you know, Portugal, Spain and Greece, and you mentioned Italy, is, you know, which is, you know, the biggest economy that's potentially under threat, but people are not talking about it in the same way as those other countries at the moment. But those three countries, and Ireland in particular, the problem for them is that their exporters cannot do the traditional thing, which is to cut the value of their currency because they're stuck into the eurozone, so they can't grow in order to pay this off. And we are seeing now recession type riots right across Europe. There have been major riots in France. There's been weekly student demonstrations getting more and more violent in London. We're not part of the euro, but it's all part of the same picture.
David Lawton, foreign correspondent for the BBC. Short break here, and when we come back, your email, and we'll open the phones.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at metlife.org. By the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting unconventional approaches to transform health and health care at rwjf.org/pioneer. This is NPR.
Dave Brubeck celebrates his 90th birthday Monday. On the next Fresh Air, we feature our 1999 interview with him. He studied piano with his mother, but he rebelled.
I wanted to be like my father, who was a cattleman and a rodeo roper.
Brubeck's father managed a 45,000-acre cattle ranch. How did Dave Brubeck end up at the piano? We find out on the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back, and it's time now to open the phones. We'll go first to Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning, Amir. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for a great show. Always love listening to you.
Thank you.
I had a couple of quick comments. One, just because you guys were talking about the corruption charges in Afghanistan and Karzai that were revealed in WikiLeaks, I just had a question because the last hour you were talking about the politics, and if there was a scenario where in Afghanistan there was a democracy and basically they had the same system where LLCs were set up and LLCs were allowed to fund campaigns and channel money to Karzai that way, the way kind of the system is set up here, would that still be called corruption? Or maybe they just haven't advanced the way the money is being funded and politics is being funded over there to the system here where And that kind of shows the kind of they're just calling it by a different name. And one other quick comment is, I noticed that after the WikiLeaks came out, the day after they announced that the next leaks are going to be about the Bank of America or different banks and corporations. And it's kind of funny to me that as strong and as powerful the U.S. intelligence is, they couldn't be more proactive about this information getting out and stopping the Amazon and stopping the servers if they wanted to before. But it seems like now that the next target is the corporations, they're using this kind of as an excuse to stop what's coming next.
Nadia.
Well, that's interesting, of course. I mean, that's the expectation that the banking industry altogether and some information that he's going to reveal in particular about the Bank of America. And, of course, this is going to threaten the economy of all countries, mainly the United States, and everybody's going to act. It's different than talking about the king said he wanted to do this or that or some information about gossip about that this or that leader. But I think when the information is precisely going to target something to do with the banking system, it becomes more than national security issue. You know, it can lead to collapse of countries. And we're just talking about what happened in Europe and the bailout. I mean, who's going to bail out the United States if something like this happened?
Yeah, that was kind of my point when I was taking the devil's advocate point of view, is that, you know, if you can hold this belief that everyone should know everything, having seen how complicated this world works, I'm not sure everyone should know everything. I mean, there's a reason why the FBI runs a witness protection program. Should we all know where those people are? Should we all know that it codes to the nuclear weapons? So this, you know, this makes us confront the decision: what really is legitimately, for economic or security reasons, something that should be not in the public domain, and what is? It's a healthy debate, but I don't think I fall onto the side that says everyone should know everything.
All right, to Nashville, Tennessee. Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning. On the Afghanistan issue, I know there are no easy answers with the power vacuums and the politics and the infrastructure and corruption and the police, but the one thing we do kind of have a direct hand over is how we take the fight to the enemy, how we continue and consistently take the fight to the enemy. And are we at least making progress in that realm? I mean, with the drone strikes and taking out more high-ranking members of the Taliban and al-Qaeda, I think a lot of Americans realize the difficulties of it, and there are no easy answers in some aspects, but we still want to believe that we're over there taking the fight to the enemy. And I just wanted to see how the panel feels.
Sure.
On are we making progress there?
David.
The war is on a completely different momentum this year. Thousands, literally, of mid-level Taliban individuals have been killed, mostly with special forces raids at night. It's completely changed in terms of the military tactics on the ground, many of them by British special forces during this year. The average life cycle at the moment of a Taliban commander in southern Afghanistan is less than 3 weeks. There's a huge amount of intelligence which is going in. The danger is the U.S. administration suddenly believes, you know, we're back to Vietnam body counts, that actually they're going to destroy the Taliban by killing that many people. They're certainly disrupting their ability to operate at the moment, but there are very many more individuals who are willing to come across the border from Pakistan.
And I agree with everything David just said. And you know, that part, that is not, you know, we're not out. General Petraeus certainly doesn't think he's going to kill his way out of this war, but he thinks that to have fruitful negotiations with the Taliban, you have to put pressure on them and convince them they're not winning. And so this is part of a plan to basically convince the Taliban to come to the negotiating table, which we've been trying to facilitate. But there has been a very dramatic ratcheting up of going after Taliban leadership. But again, you know, they have sanctuaries, so it's not easy. But so, you know, and their ranks can be refilled, but they are on their heels a bit in the areas where we have, you know, concentrated this effort in the south near Kandahar.
With President Obama in Afghanistan today, with an anticipated meeting, we presume, with President Karzai, what do you think that conversation is going to entail? Nadia?
Well, there's going to be so many topics on the table. I mean, most importantly, is going to be how for the president is he has to have a viable partner, and for him he needs an assurance from President Karzai that he's not the President Karzai of yesterday. He wanted a new leader that he can rely on. It's going to be a tough battle for him because nothing is going to change politically, but militarily, I think it's important for the U.S. to make gains militarily to force the moderate Taliban to negotiate. I think the problem for them is not just clearing the areas by killing as many Taliban fighters as they can, but to hold the areas, to clean them and to hold them. And this is important because this is will be the evidence that the U.S. strategy militarily is succeeding in Afghanistan. The problem with the drones is very controversial. They might kill a few leaders in the North Waziristan area. They create more enemies and more civilians
because
are killed.
Because
they kill many civilians in the process when they target one person. And these people are able to mushroom and to breed and to bring more people who are even more radical and more hateful mm-hmm. towards the Americans.
Mm. Hey, but the tempo of the war is making things better on the ground. I mean, you know, I was last in southern Afghanistan about 3 months ago, and at Lashkargah, which is a town you used not to be able to walk around with, you know, without a flak jacket and, you know, plenty of security. I walked around with an Afghan colleague. The market, the bazaars were working. We walked along the riverbank, you know, had conversations with men who were dressed in those big, you know, black turbans that the Taliban wear. They could well have once been Taliban, but didn't seem to be at all unhappy about me being around. And a real sense of quite a different kind of life. And what Afghans want is what anybody wants, is which is to be able to bring up their families in peace and security. And it's beginning to happen.
To Lenore, North Carolina. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question involves the hacking of the WikiLeaks site. I've associated or been involved with those who are associated with the security industry on both the professional and non-professional level for about 20 years. And I've seen that there are pretty much three types of hackers, those who are bent on monetary gain, disruption of systems, or those who seek to expose information. How is hacking WikiLeaks going to benefit any of those? I don't really understand who would have hacked it. It doesn't fit any of the profiles, I guess, in short. Any questions being asked about the hacking of the WikiLeaks site? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling, James.
I assure you there are some reporters who are on that story. Whether they'll get to the bottom of it, I don't know. It's very hard, as we've seen in all the hacking done against our systems. It's very easy to hide the fingerprints of who the hackers are. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if this was the U.S. government that was, we have an offensive cyber war capability. This is obviously seen as our Justice Department's investigation of him for spying, obviously seen as a national security threat. And for them to actually try to take down the sites, I have no proof, no evidence, but it would not surprise me.
Fred in Fairfax wants to know how you all understand the journalistic ethics related to WikiLeaks. It would seem as though, he says, the press is fencing stolen goods. Nadia.
Well, look, if you look at WikiLeaks again, they have exposed things that we didn't know about. And I remember being on this show, Diane, when we talked a year ago probably about the killing of civilians in Iraq by an Apache helicopter that included two Reuters reporters. We didn't know. We had an evidence. We heard the conversation. WikiLeaks also did an extensive report about corruption in Kenya and Tanzania. So there's good things that they have done. Now, saying that, as I agree, I mean, it's important for us, for journalists, for the public, for any democracies, to know what is going on, and especially if the government is planning, an attack on another country. But saying that, I agree that there are certain things, maybe it's not in the interest of the public domain, all of it to be revealed, and we have to be cautioned about that. But even if they hack the site, I think there is ways of trying to send this information. Now we are in a WikiLeaks kind of a new life and a new way of dealing with information. Even if Julian Assange, and by the way, there was news that he might be arrested today that I read before we came on the show, and he's the location's outside of London, and they know exactly where he is, his phone number. Even if he was arrested today, they think that other people will carry on and they will tell us more about what's happening in
David.
The world.
Well, the New York Times and Washington Post have passed what they've published in front of U.S. security, and U.S. security has asked them to take, the State Department asked them to take out certain things. They didn't take out all of the things that they were asked to take out. They only took out things that they believed were genuine security, not things that were politically embarrassing. And I think there was the journalists were slightly taking a high-handed view in that, in saying that we are the people who know what security is. But there has been a genuine, honest attempt to try and do this stuff honestly. I think American journalists wouldn't go as far as Le Monde, which is the other main European publication other than The Guardian, which has carried these. And Le Monde had a very a slightly pompous leading article which said that they had a duty to publish this material, and that, which I'm not sure is a word that would be used this side of the Atlantic.
Here's a tweet. Unless we find a way to make Pakistan act like a real ally, our forces will be in Afghanistan indefinitely.
That points to another potential fatal flaw in this. I mean, if we cannot get Pakistan to act and there are just unrestricted sanctuaries on their side of the border, the insurgency could be self-sustaining forever. That's true. Now, can we create an Afghan army that can handle it and we can get out? That's one question that we will see the answer to in, I think, the next 2-3 years. And the second question, I should point out, though, Pakistan has done more than it had done in the past. It launched an offensive into South Waziristan. It has agreed to these drone strikes. So Pakistan is showing, but it's a grudging partner. Partnership, but you have to say that Pakistan has come quite some way from where it was a few years ago.
Let me ask you all about the START arms treaty and whether support is actually building for that, David.
Well, it seems to be. I mean, you know, when you looked at the Senate hearings last year, there wasn't anybody who came in front of those hearings who said that that START shouldn't be signed. And now it seems to have got entrenched in U.S. partisan politics. And if it got stuck there, then that would be a shame. Here we have, you know, the lame duck session of Congress. You know, the math's very simple. You need 8 people at the moment. You'll need 14 with the new Senate. Sorry, rather than Congress that has to vote on this. That 14 when it comes to it. And you can see that my grasp of U.S. congressional politics is not as good as my grasp of foreign affairs. But the important aspect of this is that if the U.S. does not sign the START Treaty, its global policing role is substantially reduced. The ability of the United States to lecture other countries about nuclear non-proliferation and the ability of the United States to inspect Russian arms silos finishes now unless this treaty is signed.
Dave Loyne of the BBC, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. James.
The lesson of START is that what used to be considered a bipartisan issue, national security, has become so partisan now that people are willing, and this has been pointed out, but I'll point it out again, people are willing to play with our national security for short-term tactical political gain. And, you know, every single Republican Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, this last week, Colin Powell, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, has come out Scowcroft. I mean, everyone who has studied these things over the years has said this makes sense, and it's actually been very critical to our reset of relationships with Russia, which has been very helpful on Iran, been very helpful on our Afghanistan operations that we now resupplied through Russian airspace and soon perhaps in Russian territory. So this is it's a no-brainer, and the fact that it can be held up like this, and what the administration saw and worried about was a replay of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty in 1999, where it stuck out there and delayed until, like a piñata, it was seen as a bludgeon to knock Bill Clinton upside the head after impeachment. They were very worried that this thing drugged in the next Congress, given the hyper-partisanship, it would be used as a bludgeon somehow by people who look not at the issues involved, but just as a convenient way to hurt the president. So they have finally gotten their full court press on during this lame duck, and I think it's actually going to work. When you see John McCain and Olympia Snow and Lamar Alexander and others saying that they could support this in a lame duck session, it seems to me they've finally gotten through. I mean, really, do you want to stand up to the Joint Chiefs and the head of all our labs and say, you know, for a political reason, I'm going to vote against this, or for some nefarious idea that we're not modernizing our nuclear infrastructure quick enough? I mean, everyone knows this deal is pretty innocuous, but it should get done.
Not yet.
I actually was in an event with Senator Kerry 2 days ago, and the question of SART were asked, and he said he's confident still and hopeful that they will pass it during this lame duck session. But saying that, I agree with everything that both of you have said. It became hostage to politics. There is no doubt about it. I mean, when you have Senator like Kyle from Arizona linking it to the tax cuts, you know, to the Bush tax cuts and saying, like, maybe I'll think about it, etc. And I think it shows that President Obama is weakened internationally if he is unable to pass a treaty like this that expired a year ago. And now he cannot pass it simply with, as you said, every other Republican president, Secretary of State, has already said it's in our national interest. If your defense secretary is saying that, if your commander-in-chief of the U.S. Army is saying that, and now the president is unable to do it, it shows him very weak. And on addition of that, you have Putin. We have Prime Minister Putin saying, basically, if you guys, we want to work with you, but if you're not going to pass it, we have to go our way, because we're not going to allow our security to be held hostage to U.S. politics, and we're going to build something against this defense shield in Europe.
Last word, David.
Remember that what's at stake is reducing Russia's nuclear weapons by a third. There's got to be something worth it in that, hasn't there?
David Loin, he's foreign correspondent for the BBC. Nadia Bilbasi, senior U.S. correspondent for the Middle East Broadcast Center. James Kitfield, senior correspondent for National Journal Magazine. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend, everybody. Stay safe. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.